found this in Ganarum. Ganamir Ni.
What is it?
Well, it's
simple things.
Welcome to Synthaholics, guys. This is your host, David Duncan, and with me is
Aaron O'Brien. And we have a very special guest. We have G.S. Davis, or Guy Davis. He is the creator, illustrator, writer of the USS Tamberlin. It's a webcomic that he's been putting together for some time now, and I've been a big fan for quite a few years. I've been reading him off and on when he's been doing his posts, and I'm very, very excited to have you on here, Guy. This is great. I'm a big comic nerd. I know Dave is, but I think I'm a bigger comic nerd.
You're a bigger comic nerd.
Right.
That is confirmed.
But it's been scientifically proven.
The Mythbusters don't even need to try this one.
They shot me out of a cannon, and that was it. So,
thank you for coming on the show, Guy.
Yeah.
Thank you for having me. Thank you very much.
Yeah, just to give everyone a background, if you don't know what the USS Tamberlin is, it's a webcomic. It takes place during the original series time period, and we have a... it's a Saladin class destroyer, so it's not a Constitution class. And they run into the big long story that guys put together is the Champion. It's a very long story about how they come across some kind of living weapon of mass destruction, and how they have to make a moral decision on what to do with it before it kills more people. And there's a lot of moral questions during that, and especially latter half. But it's commanded by Captain Cochran, and she is a descendant to Zephon Cochran, correct?
That's correct, yeah.
Yeah.
It's a good thing Kirk didn't find this weapon of mass destruction.
Why? What would he do?
Oh, she was naked when you first see her, so it's like Kirk would have...
No, he would have been killed. He would have been. Maybe that's what half the problem with the Orion ship.
No, but Kirk is smoother talking than the Orions.
That's
true. Like, if you've seen Lolani, like they're pretty mean to their women.
Well,
Kirk is more smooth.
Right, right. Well, the Champion actually has no real form. Right. It seems they changed because it seemed like it was in male form before, and then. It changed to the
girl form, yeah.
Right, mm-hmm. Right. So, I mean, but I guess anything goes. I guess that was more of a thing for Riker.
Yeah.
Well, this is more the Kirkish time period with the that type of class ship.
I know.
Although, like, I think I was looking at Memory Alpha, and the Saladin class ship shows up, like, on a view screen in the background of Wrath of Khan.
It does.
Like, the outline of it.
In Star Trek III, too, because when they're doing the intruder alert sequence, it shows up there, so that makes it canon.
And
that's awesome.
And so, Guy, so that design was from Franz Joseph. He's he did a whole bunch of technical drawings for Starfleet technical manual. Did you have that when you were younger, or do you still have that? I mean, I remember that when I was younger. I don't have it anymore. It's gone.
Yeah, actually, that was one of my I'd sit there and just page through it and dream sort of books.
Yeah.
But yeah, I had and now I've got four copies of it.
Do you really?
Yeah, because I keep finding them, and I keep going, oh, this is great. This one's better than the last copy, which is weird because now I've got all these copies, and I'm like, well, what?
Do you want to send me a crappy copy?
I'll have to send you one. But I actually, the last one I got was one of the original red cover ones.
Oh.
Because I go through it so often.
I just remember the black one. That's a black cover? That's what it was?
Yeah, the black cover was the reissue for the 20th anniversary.
Okay.
I had a blue cover, I think, but it was just Enterprise A. It had, like, all the decks and all the layouts.
Oh, Mr. Scott's Guide to the Enterprise.
Yeah, we had that. I had that when I was a kid.
Well, this was, like... So these were like spec drawings. They had the ships. They had tricorder breakdowns. They had uniforms, and even like the patterns how to cut the uniforms. I believe. It was just one of those things that just like we're going pre-internet, so none of this stuff was available. So when you had it, you're like, wow, this is crazy. dreamt up all this and did all this, you know, and so this is cool. So this guy, Franz Joseph, he came up with the blueprints for all this. Now, did he design all that, do you know, or how do you
know? Yeah, so from what I understand, Franz Joseph originally was brought on board in 75 to do that book.
Okay.
And sort of expand the universe a little bit because the fans were kind of getting into Star Trek, and of course this is early in the syndication. And from what I understand, he did all of that, and then there was a dispute between him and Gene Roddenberry over who owned the rights to it or something really weird like that, because that happened a lot with Roddenberry. And so because of that...
I was laughing at myself when you said that.
Yeah. Well, I mean, you're like, that happened a lot.
If you watch the Trouble on the Bridge or whatever.
Crisis on the Bridge.
Have you seen that?
Yes.
Like, it's just like he was fighting everybody. He had that lawyer in there just to be a dick to everyone. It was like awful.
Well, go on. So they had the dispute.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. That was kind of the thing he did. You know, he was... I think it was because he kind of figured he only had one good thing in him or whatever because he wasn't doing so successful with all the other shows that he had done, like The Lieutenant and other things like that. But anyway, there was a dispute, and you know, Franz Joseph got all of the rights to it.
Oh.
And so that's when you had all of the rules coming out in Star Trek where warp nacelles had to be in pairs. And that was the whole point.
Right.
So that it was disputable between so that he could decanonize that tech manual.
Okay.
But since then, people kind of taken it as, you know, since he passed away, people have kind of taken that to be not as canonical.
Yeah.
And, of course, we saw in All Good Things, we saw 3 warp nacelled Enterprise D.
Right.
And, of course, I sort of try to stay in canon. The Tamerlan has what I call the doppelganger warp drive.
Right.
And it has a warp, it has a little extended antenna that puts it extends the warp field up and around. So that I can keep the 2 warp nacelle rules sort of fitting in.
Okay.
So it makes a fake warp nacelle on top of the ship. And I try to stay in canon as much as I can. It's, you know, I'm an old school Trekkie, so I work really hard to stay in canon.
Right. Yeah. And I was going to say, because, I mean, from everything you've put together with your stories, so you have you're referencing, Franz Joseph's design. So that's you're going back, and then you're also you start off the comic with the Battle of Dutan 5?
Dona 2-5.
I'm sorry, and right by Sherman's Planet, by the way.
Ooh.
Yeah, right by Planet.
Klingons love that place.
Yeah, they just so that's where the we first see the Tamerlan, and unfortunately, that's not. It's a previous captain who we see their her demise pretty quickly. The bridge just gets completely obliterated by a D7, which was probably a mismatch.
Yeah, heavy cruiser versus destroyer, probably not a very good fight.
Yeah. Now, did you ever play the Starfleet battles when that was?
Oh yeah.
Yeah, you remember
way
that?
Way too much.
Yeah? Okay, that's awesome. Okay, cool. Because, I mean, not a lot of people know that nowadays. It's kind of a bygone thing.
It is.
Yeah.
Although they've got Federation Commander now, which is a kind of a simpler version of Starfleet Battles, which I like to play too.
Is that a tabletop?
Yeah, it's tabletop. And it uses the same minis.
Oh,
and
really?
They've got a whole new line now of much better designed minis than the
really?
Last patch. Yeah.
Awesome. I'll look it up.
I can't find the old DDs. They're not really. I don't know if they had a problem with the Franz Joseph rights or something like that.
Okay.
Although I communicated with Franz Joseph, of course, passed away, mm-hmm. and I communicated with Karen Dick, which is Franz Joseph's daughter.
Oh.
And she's given me tacit approval to use his design.
Wow.
Myself and Ken Thompson's USS Saladin, Starship Saladin. We both kind of reached out to her and said, "Hey, we're using the destroyer. Is that cool?" And she's like, "Yeah, it's cool."
Wow!
So
that's great.
It really is nice because she's just a nice person. She'd been reading the comics and she's like, "I really like that you have a female captain." And I was like, "Oh, that's cool."
And yeah, and you actually. So after we have the unfortunate first captain. Killed. We have the new captain, Captain Cochran. But you have most of the officers are all women, which is it's different. I don't mind it. I think it's actually refreshing to see more women in the command position. But that's was that just a just came up that way, or how did that come about that you just decided you're going to have more women officers?
Well, originally I was trying to do it in a gender-flipped version of TOS.
Yeah.
But then I ended up with one man, and it really looked really awkward and strange. So I went for 50-50 because the population of the world is 50-50.
Right.
So I've got four women and four men in my command staff. I just haven't developed my men very much.
Right. Well, yeah, the women are sort of, you know, the biggest, you know, you have the engineer Ward and the first officer Bennett. So, and those are the most prominent characters.
That's my trio or triad. Yeah.
Yeah. So it's great. And I guess I got just a crap load of questions for you because I have been reading for a while. I think I stumbled upon your the Tamberlin. Maybe it was maybe in the 2008, 2009. I can't quite remember exactly when that was. And I've been reading off and on since then. And then I stumbled upon you had the Facebook page up a couple years back. So, and I, you know, that's when I started catching up back up with everything else that you put out. I mean, obviously, you've put together some pretty lengthy stories of The Champion, Last Night of the Year, and By Her Reason Swayed. So those are, you know, all really great stories. Obviously, The Champion's the longest one you did. What's your plans for The Tamberlin in the future? Do you have any, like, I know you've been putting out some new content now, but what any other ideas, what you're, or can you reveal that you're trying to work towards?
Well, actually, I'm starting to go weekly now, which is the new thing. It was taking way too long to do these comics that would take forever and ever and ever.
Yeah.
And so now we're on The Lark and the Nightingale, which is the newest episode. And we're only one whole, well, I guess we'll be a couple of them out by the time the podcast comes out. So there will be a few of them out there.
Cool.
That are on the website. So that's my new plan, is to go weekly now. It's one of those things. I have a stretch goal for my Patreon is to start going twice a week.
Wow.
So that's one of the things that, you know, it takes time to do these things, and so I can only do one page a week right now. But that's because I'm doing other things.
No, I understand.
I'd much rather do the comics twice a week.
All day long. Yeah, just so everyone knows, if you want to find his Patreon, it's patreon.com/GS Davis Art. And that's his Patreon. If you want to find his webpage, it's ustamberlin.com, or you can go to facebook.com /ustamberlin. So.
And all these will be in the show notes. So,
yeah, we'll put the list of everything so everyone can see it.
So if you didn't get to write that down just now, right quick, go down to the show notes on the webpage or wherever you find it on Facebook.
What, you're not fast enough, writer? You don't have a pen by you all the time?
Or maybe you just
driving?
Or maybe you have Dragon Dictation up and it just held the phone up to the speaker and you just like had it us dictate to it?
Knowing our audience, they're probably passed off in a bathroom stall. with illegal substances, so
I'm getting yelled at work.
They're getting yelled at work.
Are you listening to podcasts again? Do your work.
It's not because they're listening. It's because they accidentally pulled the plug and then were shouting out into their work environment.
Yes. So so check that out. His Patreon. It's definitely worth it. I mean, and definitely if you haven't checked out the U.S. Tamberlin, check that out too. So
Aaron's been a fan of this for years. I've been a fan of this for weeks. Whenever he told me about it 2 weeks ago, it's like sweet.
So I want to just drill down a couple things on a comic. So why don't we just talk about your past? Like, when did you first get into Star Trek? First of all, like, was it a young child, or did you get it later on, or?
When I was 3 years old, back when TV stations had three-letter call letters, I remember my mom and I would like sit on the couch and we'd watch the old series in reruns. And I remember then, after that, one of my favorite things was my dad and my mom and I would all sit around and talk about, so what did you learn from that episode?
Well, that's amazing. So your parents were like trying to give you like the moral implications of each show.
I mean, I remember Let This Be Your Last Battlefield, the half white, half black.
Yeah.
And they were saying, did you understand what they were talking about? Because we're, you know, my family at the time, my family had come from the South. And, you know, there's a lot of tension sure. between the racial tensions here in the South. And so I was sitting there saying, I think so. You know, and I remember talking about that, and that was kind of the first time I realized there was tensions between races. I didn't even, you know, I grew up in Colorado because my dad was transferred there when I was really young. Uh-huh. And he moved back here, obviously. But yeah, so it was one of those things that's what got me started in it. And I just loved Star Trek from that point on. I'm 2 days younger than Will Wheaton. Wow. So, I mean, his birthday is the 29th of July, and mine's the 31st. So
you were so jealous whenever he got the role of Wesley,
and
you didn't.
It made me so mad. I was like, I could be on the bridge, man. I could be on the bridge.
I could be wearing that sweet rainbow sweater.
Very sweet.
Or that orange one where that was like salmon colored or something.
And I could hug Beverly Crusher.
Crusher.
I was actually thinking about what's her name?
Deanna Troi.
No.
Denise Crosby. No.
What's her name? The singer that was on there. She was played Ensign. I can't. Why am I completely blank on her name? Holy moly! Am I an idiot or what?
Which episode? I need more reference than.
It'll come back to me.
Okay.
Give me a moment.
Gotcha.
I personally like the engineer Sonia Gomez.
Gomez.
How she dumped all that stuff over on Picard.
Right,
yep,
right.
The hot chocolate on Picard girl. I loved her. She was the one I had the crush on.
I liked her a lot too, and I was really sad that like she was only like two episodes.
Only two episodes. But there was a lot of development for a character. It was only on two episodes. You know?
Yeah, it was odd that she showed up and then it was like there was all
gone.
This. Yeah. Well, yeah, just
we're obviously building her up, and then oh, never mind. We've decided not to do that.
Right.
I wonder what the story is behind that.
Yeah. Right.
But yeah, I've been a Trekkie all of my life. I was the one who made the cardboard phasers and communicators and tricorders and ran around the playground until somebody beat me up for it. That was sort of my history.
Those bastards.
Those bastards.
I had a like a little makeup compact that was square, and I made it look like a flip communicator.
Nice. Yep.
And that's what I did.
I had the flip communicator walkie-talkies when I was a kid, like that actually worked as walkie-talkies, except for the giant antenna that came out of the top of it. When Star Trek V came out, we sent out the UPC offers for the marshmallow dispensers.
Oh,
and
yeah.
I was like, how come it doesn't do it automatically?
Oh, God.
Yeah.
I mean, I was like 5 or 6 at the time. So, I mean, like, mm-hmm. I was a little bit older than that, but still, I was like, why doesn't this work the way it did in the movie?
Right.
Yeah, right. Well, it wasn't meant to.
I was too young to comprehend that.
So you were very young. That's really cool that your parents actually would hash out the story behind it, the moral implications of especially original series.
Yeah, my parents never did that with me, but my dad is a preacher, and occasionally he would pull out the moral implications into a sermon. Sometimes with Star Trek,
I was
that's cool.
I was left to figure it out on my own, so I didn't get half of it. But now I do.
Are you sure?
Probably not. I'm probably way off.
That's only why we do the podcast.
Let this last be your last battlefield is about vanilla and chocolate, right?
Yeah,
that's exactly what that's about.
It's about Oreos and not Oreos.
Yeah.
But like Metropolitan ice cream or Neapolitan ice cream or whatever that's called.
Without the pink.
Yeah, nobody wants the strawberry.
It sounds gross.
Anyways, obviously you're an artist and you've been doing art. Now, your art is definitely, I mean, you have these great shots of the spaceships, but then your art is also very callback to a lot of like manga, anime. So I'm assuming that's probably a big influence with you as well.
Absolutely. I started when I was a kid. I didn't like because I was growing up in the 80s, and that really wasn't a good era for American comics at all. Because, I mean, you look back at them, the stories are so flat, and they were, you know, they didn't develop their characters very much until, like, the 90s. They had this resurgence. It was great. Yeah. And I wasn't reading the Golden Age comics. I was, you know, because that's – who can afford those
but you
comics?
But they weren't around, yeah. Wasn't on the newsstand.
So I got into Japanese animation when I was in high school. Mm-hmm. And I started with Macross, which was called Robotech.
Yeah,
here.
I love that. Yep.
Oh, yeah.
And that's what influenced my art. Especially Haruhiko Mikimoto, who's the artist, the character designer for Macross, and he really influenced my work. And so because of that, that's where my work sort of developed out of.
Yeah.
I've got this kind of somewhere between manga and American style in my right. strips, and that's just where I go, I guess. I don't know.
I like it a lot. I like how diverse it is. And then, like, you get the exterior views of the ships, which are very American, I think, as far as the design. I mean, it's Star Trek design, but, I mean, just the way it's drawn.
Well, I mean, if you look at Robotech Macross, that's how it is. You have these, you know, a more cartoony version of the character, but then the machinery is just so, like...
Crazy, yeah.
Yeah, so very illustrated and very technical looking and stuff like that. So, I mean, I'm big... I grew up with Robotech, and I also grew up with Star Blazers. And,
oh, yeah.
What else was it? There was a couple of few. So when you're going back, did you actually see the original Macross, or did you just see the Robotech series that was on TV?
So we were watching Robotech, my buddies and I, in an unused room of my high school. It's kind of one of those things between classes, we had these gaps. Mm-hmm. And all of us would go to this room, and we'd swipe one of the AV machines, and we'd watch Robotech. Huh. And somewhere along the line, one of my friends said, "Oh, if you like this, you need to see the Macross movie."
Huh.
And I said, "What's that?"
Yeah.
And I had never seen, you know, I mean, that movie just blew my mind because it was in Japanese.
Right.
And, of course, I didn't speak a word of Japanese.
No, you didn't have to, really.
Yeah, you didn't have to. It was pretty much, you know, but I started watching it, and I was like, dude, people are getting beheaded. Yeah. Oh, my God. I've never seen that in a cartoon before.
Yeah.
And it just totally shattered my world, you know. It took a long time for America to kind of catch up in the animation style.
Oh, absolutely.
With the depth of storytelling they could get away with in anime.
Right.
And
right.
So.
Totally agree. My first anime was probably Vampire Hunter D when I was like a teenager.
Okay.
Yeah.
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 Yeah, so I was a big Macross fan. I did not like I like Robotech Macross. I didn't like Southern Cross whatsoever. I couldn't get into that. But then I liked the Invid Invasion, or what are they called, the Next Generation, or whatever they was called. It was
Genesis Primer Mos Piata.
Yeah, uh-huh. That I enjoyed that. So
Seems to be kind of typical with the Robotech fans. I'm sort of the same way.
Yeah, I just Southern Cross did nothing for me. Side note, the person I was thinking was Ashley Judd. Ashley Judd was in Next Generation. And
yes, that's right.
I could kiss her.
Oh, that's from the isn't that the game where?
It was the game. Yeah, she was the one that had the rules, wasn't she? She had like because it was her. She was Ensign. Oh, come on!
Ensign Robin Leffler.
Leffler.
Yeah,
Leffler. That's Leffler. It.
Yeah, so she, and she, I don't think she was even like a big star at the time. She was just a nobody. Like, no. I mean, she was related to the Judds, obviously, who are, you know, the sisters who sing together and write the songs.
Yeah.
But she wasn't like anybody to speak of at the time. So, anyways, let's not talk about Ashley Judd because I could talk for hours.
Oh, really now?
Yeah. But I won't. So, okay, so you're into anime, and obviously you had the background of Star Trek growing up. Now, where did you go from there? Did you go to art school at all, or did you start drawing on your own, or how did that start?
Well, I was drawing on my own, and then I went to CU Boulder for a while, and then did the I'm much better than school and dropped out, which was one of those top 10 mistakes you make in life.
A lot of people do that.
Yeah, it took me another decade, but I went back to college in the beginning of this millennia, and got an animation degree, which is actually what I have. I have a bachelor's in animation.
Nice,
awesome.
That's actually one of the, you know, back to my plugging my Patreon, that's my big goal, is if we can get, you know, high enough up there as a group, I intend to start making animation.
Wow.
Again.
Great.
So
good for you.
And the traditional style, the hand-drawn, I'm one of those people, I just really loved sitting there drawing a frame. Yeah. And then onion skinning the next frame, and then onion skinning the next frame.
Right.
And onion skinning is the technique where they use really thin paper that you can see through, so you can trace the next frame, mm-hmm. you know, slightly different than the frame before. And that's very zen for me.
You so. Like doing that. And
I did, yeah.
And now, were you drawing comics for a while, or was this like was just something that you started just stumbling upon over time to do, like, you know, like the Tamberlin story or your other comics that you've been working on? I mean, how did that kind of evolve?
Well, I started drawing comics in 91, actually. It was 91 for the local anime magazine.
Okay.
Because there was a little group that got together in Denver every month and just watched anime. And they had the little magazine, because of course they couldn't subtitle them back then. This is before computers were very powerful. And so it took a lot of effort to subtitle some. So what they do is they just get these tapes in from Japan and play them. Hmm. And so they put out synopses for the guys that spoke Japanese would, you know, say, oh, this episode's about, you know, the dirty pair go and do this thing, and then they get, you know, involved in this problem. Dirty pair is another one that's a lot of fun.
Yeah.
You know, and they explain, you know, sort of explain the little synopses. Well, those synopses books, we'd add content to. So I started writing a comic then called Michiko's Angel, which was about a girl who could see this. She was a Japanese schoolgirl, because they all are. And yeah. She can see
they don't
this.
Have any other girls in Japan.
There's no other girls in Japan, just Japanese
school. Stay in school.
They're
forever.
All evil.
Stay in
and
school.
Super powerful.
or
and
ninjas.
She met she sees this World War II bomber pilot. And it turns out he's a ghost, and she's the only one that can see him. And he needs to have these scrolls written up so that, you know, he could pass on to the next life. And so he needs to convince her to help him do this. And so I wrote that for a long time. And then and the art is atrocious. And I look back at it and I'm like, I can't believe I wrote that. And the story isn't very hot either. So the premise isn't bad, but the story really didn't live up to the premise.
I see.
But yeah,
it definitely sounds, you know, kind of anime-ish.
It was a very classic anime sort of style. I think I was there was Yu Yu Hakusho was one that was going on at the time. And it's very much like that. You know, they're all kind of spirit-related sort of stories. So I've been drawing for a very long time in comics. It was one of those things, I didn't quite grasp this internet-y thing until very late in the game.
Right, right.
And so...
Well, that's the thing is, too, because comic readers are always pretty much like paper... And, you know, books kind of thing. We're all like, you know, oh, you know, that's what you grew up with. That's what you – and, you know, I mean, it's not that you couldn't make the jump to that, but that's where your heart is.
Right.
And right. But the reality is I think the webcomics reach a bigger audience than if you would to be, you know, just to print them and try to distribute them or get them distributed, because it's just – you're going to just reach people from all over the world.
Sure.
And people find your niche over time, but it takes them a while to, you know, to build that audience, but you have a better chance. So
just like what we're trying to do.
Right, exactly.
Did you ever see the documentary Kingdom of Dreams and Madness?
Yeah,
it's about the what's his name? It's the director, animator, what's his name? Hideo...
Miyazaki?
Yeah, Miyazaki, yeah.
Oh, yeah.
It's a documentary about him. It's in, you know, kind of like making his last... one of his last films and stuff like that. So it's really great. I mean, interesting to see how he works, because he's supposedly the master of that genre, so... Or at least living master. I don't know. Yeah. I'm not a...
One of my stories about anime the first one I ever saw was Nausicaä, you know. So Kaze no Tani no Nausicaä, which is Nausicaä in the Valley of the Wind.
Mm-hmm.
And I had missed, you know, it was 1986, 87, something like that. And I was homesick, you know. So I was laying on the couch flipping through the TV channels and I stumbled across it and it had already started. you know, the show had already started. So I was like 5 minutes in or 6 minutes in. And I was like, oh, I'll watch this. And I watched the whole thing through. And then, you know, of course, then they did the typical HBO thing. They cut off the end credits and then went on to something else.
Yeah, you have no idea.
I had no idea what it was called, and I was like, that was the most beautiful thing I have ever seen. And then I was all, like, depressed. I actually started crying because my mom had thrown away the TV guide, and I was never going to be able to find it again now. You know, this is before the channel that you could go to.
That sure, yeah, they had all the channels, yeah.
So, yeah, I was like,
you know, it's weird that it's, like, so strange that, like, any younger listeners are going to be like, what kind of, like, Stone Age world did people live in before the internet?
Oh, yeah, like, you had to, like, I mean, I remember, like, I mean, I'm not super old. I mean, I'm 32, but I remember, like, having to, like, look at, you know, like, the Sunday paper to see what was going to be on every week and the TV guide and then... Like, it wasn't until I was, like, you know, a teenager until we had the scrolly thing.
I remember the writing on the cave walls and letting my mom know what I did for that day.
Of your TV with smoke signals.
Hunting woolly mammoths.
That was my first comics right there. You know, go to Lascaux, France. Those are my first comics right there.
There you go.
The AD comics?
Yeah, the AD comics or BC comics.
Oh, BC comics. I'm sorry. Yeah. No, I'm like,
BC is great. Yeah.
Okay, so you start drawing it, and then you're getting into anime, doing your own anime, and then what spurred the idea of doing a Tamberlin or a Star Trek, you know, based story?
It goes back quite a ways. I was watching Next Gen, and we were in second season, I believe, and a friend of mine was like, and I was talking to him about it, and he was watching Next Gen as well. And he's like, well, yeah, but it's the Enterprise again. I mean, it's always the Enterprise. What, there are no other ships? I want to see Star Trek, the rest of the Federation.
Yeah.
And so the germ was sort of started there about using a ship that has nothing to do with the Enterprise.
Right.
You know? And then later, you know, fast forward another 20 years, or, yeah, I guess nearly 20 years, because it was 2005, and I was talking to him about this, and he said, you remember when we were talking about Star Trek, the rest of the Federation? Well, now we've got Voyager and DS9, and this is just as Enterprise was starting up. And he's like, and now we're back to Enterprise again. And I was like, yeah, we really need to do something about that. And I started thinking about this, started sketching this out, and that was when I started I wonder if I could gender flip the crew.
Right.
And I was like, wow, that really looks really strange. And it's interesting, a statement of our culture, that it looked really weird and awkward to have an all-female with one male.
Right, right.
You know, I was like, it's interesting that we thought it was perfectly normal to have all males and one female, but it's really weird to have all females and one male.
Yeah.
And I thought that was interesting, and I thought, well, this is an interesting vehicle to explore. Now I can really kind of dig down, but I didn't want, you know, Captain Kirk could beat up anything.
Right.
So I was like, you know what? I need to come up with a captain that is like the anti-Kirk. So I came up with a 5'2" Asian girl who couldn't fight her way out of a paper bag.
Right.
You know, and I thought, that's perfect. You know, she's really sharp. She's really smart. And that's not what she does. She does not beat on people.
Right. Right.
And so then I took the idea of taking a destroyer, which is like a warship. It's got phasers and photon torpedoes, and now it's thrown in Gene Roddenberry's peaceful universe.
Right, right. So in fact, what was it? Let me just find here. Yeah. So your line here is 20. So they in the comic, I think the Champion says it has a 25-year mission, and it's to stay and hold the line. Is that
hold the line?
Yeah,
hold the line. So that's there instead of boldly go where no man's gone before. It's to hold the line. Don't fall back.
Let the Klingons win.
Yeah, exactly. That was what I envisioned, because there has always been sort of a timeline analogy between TOS and the real world at that time. So it was 2260 something, and you know they were trying to run a line directly to 1960. So you draw that back, you figure the Klingon War would have been World War II.
Yeah.
Right. I mean, because that would have been 2240, you know, 2241 or 1941.
Right.
You know.
Right.
So I figured they built this ship as a fighter to go into the war.
Right.
And so now it's 1968, and you've got a World War II battleship. Well, what are you going to do with it?
Right.
You know,
yeah.
it's a you know it's And, you know, of course, then Gene Roddenberry sort of built this world. And I love irony. I really love the irony of it. I love exploring the fact that Tamerlan hasn't fired her phasers in anger in like 20 years, maybe 15.
Yeah.
You know, story.
Yeah. In fact, was it Bennett and Cochran get an argument about that when they're to do with the champion? They're just like, you know, that's the reason we have phasers and torpedoes on the ship. This is, we're not here just for, you know, peaceful purposes. We have, you know, also a military side as well, you know.
Right.
So,
yeah. I like that part a lot.
Yeah, that was a great, like, where, you know, they're going through the moral dilemma. So now, what drew you to do the Saladin class ship? Like, I mean, obviously you could pick any. You could pick the Dreadnought class if you wanted to. I mean, like, what made you want to do that?
Well, there was – you remember how we were talking about Starfleet battles? It seemed like when I was in school, especially in high school, my buddies and I would draw up fictional starships in the Starfleet universe. Because we were playing Starfleet battles, you know, there were a lot of different obvious different classes of ships that nobody saw.
Right.
And it seemed like everybody just wanted to go for the, you know, the more warp nacelles, the better. You know, they just keep throwing more and more warp nacelles on their ships.
Yeah.
And,
oh,
you know,
man.
More phase, more photon torpedoes, more warp nacelles. So
right.
In sort of that loving irony thing, I kind of wanted to pick
stripped
one
down.
That looked a little bit more demure,
yeah.
And not quite so threatening.
Right, right, right. Well, that's cool because, because I think the Dreadnought class the technical manual, it had a warp nacelle on its on the top, right? As
on
well,
the saucer, right?
So
yeah, coming
so
top of the saucer.
I did a 3D model of the of that too.
Yeah,
where I put the thing on top, and I even separated the saucer from the rest of the secondary hull, so it could like saucer separate if we ever needed it to. For the
according to Starfleet Battles rules, that's the point. You know, is that the Dreadnought saucer could operate as its own machine. Once it does a saucer separation, whereas, you know, a cruiser, you know, once you separate, you don't have warp power anymore.
Right.
Yeah,
right.
I really like the Dreadnought, the style of it. I would love to see like a series based on the Dreadnought, even maybe a future Dreadnought.
Right. Well, we don't go into that, but so you pick the Saladin class, and then obviously you gender flip the captains. You do a kind of antithesis of Kirk, you know. So it's a smaller female. She's not going to punch her way out of things. She's going to more think her way out of her issue and her problems. And then obviously you got to do the webcomic. Now, was that the first idea, or were you thinking of something else before that?
Well, I actually started with the idea of a webcomic, but then I wanted to test myself. I was like, okay, now wait a minute. You know, if you're going to do a webcomic, you know, and you want to keep an audience, you know, this is 05, so I've already seen a lot of other webcomics sort of starting up and getting out there. And I was like, oh, if I want to keep them, though, I've got to do something. So I wrote By Her Reason Swayed, mm-hmm. to test to see if I could put together 12 pages.
Right.
And I did, and I was all excited about that. And I was like, oh, okay, well, this is cool. I'm obviously capable of, you know, keeping the wherewithal to do this, the stick-to-itness, as my dad calls it.
Mm-hmm.
And that was a big deal for me because I did a lot of projects that I'd start and then not finish. And then start and then not finish.
Sure.
So then I started The Champion. But yeah, the intention right off the bat was to do a webcomic from that point forward.
Right.
After my friend and I had sort of hashed out some of the details of what we were doing, then I kind of said, hey, what if I did this? And what if I did this? And kind of moved on with that idea and then just kept evolving. And then another friend of mine said, you know, they invented this thing called the internet. And I was like, oh, what? I could put this on the internet.
Right.
It was like an amazing revelation, you know.
Right.
So I had started it out with the idea of, I don't know, maybe making Ashcan comics. I don't know what I had thought of when I started it. I just wanted to draw it.
Right, right. That's great because you did the 12-page Her Reason Swayed, and so you had that in the can already, and then you were working on The Champion, so that was probably easier to kind of give yourself a buffer zone to keep going and keep posting at the same time. So even if you had, like, you know, a bad week where you didn't get anything done, at least you had a little buffer on that. So that's a good thing to have going for you, that, you know, that came together. Now, How long did it take you to finish the Champion? Champion is very long. It's like it's 180 some pages. I don't know exactly.
Yeah, it's 180 pages. Yeah, that took many years. Because I think I started that in 06, and I wrapped the last one in 09. So 3 years. So I put it out in three parts in the three acts because I generally try to write in a three act structure.
That's great.
So I put the first act out. And. And back in the day of the internet, back before Facebook, I had a forum, and so I had a lot of other things that were going on in the forum at the time.
Yeah.
So there were other fan groups that were putting out fan comics and things like that in the forum.
Yeah.
So it wasn't so weird to have these 6 month gaps before the next issue came out. So I released them in, I guess, something like 40 page, it must have been more than that, must have been closer to 50 pages for each act, and I'd release it as a group.
Yeah.
And then they, of course, would find spelling errors and mistakes, and oh, it was so embarrassing.
Yeah.
And then there were people who freaked out about the nudity, and then I'm like, oh, come on. And so, you know, it's like, so I'd go back and I'd make a different version, and I'd clean it all up and straighten it out. And
wow.
Yeah, it took some time, but I'm very proud of that particular comic. It's got a good solid moral heart, and it's
beautiful.
Yeah, everything about it's great. I love it, and I'm just struck with the story is great. I love the story, and I think it holds a good, like you're saying, it holds to
canon and the feeling of Roddenberry, and it's very very Star Trek.
Yeah,
very 60s Star Trek even.
Exactly, and I like that.
I appreciate it. Thanks.
Yeah, and I like that about it, and I like that you're kind of taking your own angle of it as too. So you're not mimicking or doing the same. I mean, you could have just come up with three characters similar to Kirk, McCoy, and Spock, and and just call it a different, slap another name on the ship, and call it the Adventures of
USS Yasumoto.
Yeah, that kind of thing. That would have been easy. You reinvented this the whole dynamic, so that's great. And then the other part is what's great about it is that you have a cohesive look through the whole book. Like, it doesn't really change at all. I mean, in webcomics especially, I notice if you go any webcomic, especially something like similar to what you're doing, the original art, you go back and it's like scribbles. Mm-hmm. And then they go forward, and then like 3 years later, they're actually really good at what they're doing, and they're very good at their the arts look amazing. But you go back in the original, it's like not good, And
it's definitely a consistent look throughout.
So it seems like you cut your teeth on your earlier work before you got into this, and then you went into doing the Tamberlin. So it's great. Now. The one story that I do want to talk about just briefly is the Last Night of the Year. It's an incredibly heart-wrenching story. What made you want to write a story about Cochran and her daughter, who loses her daughter on that? Is there a reason for that, or just trying to fill in a backstory?
Well, it was mentioned in The Champion.
Well, yeah, I know, but I just wondered because it's a 12-page story, and it's colorful rendered, which is a little bit different than Champion. So it's more storybookish too. It's instead of
I haven't gotten to read that one.
Yeah, it's
that one's the one that one of the things that I was experimenting with Tamberlin is that I really wanted to try to experiment with different formats.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, like, and it still continues now. The Lark and the Nightingale is done in a Sunday comic strip format.
Gotcha.
Which is a completely different format than it's like Prince Valiant. So that's sort of more where I'm going with it on that one. So the format is sort of something I've been playing with, and I had been talking to my girlfriend at the time, who's now my wife, and she and I were talking about the idea of a storybook. And actually having one picture with a lot of text, so sort of going into going halfway to prose,
right?
And moving into that kind of, just to see what I could do with it. And Cochran has a lot of pathos about her daughter, and that is in her background, and it drives her character a lot. And I thought, I need to express this. I really need to express what happened between Cochrane and her daughter, and and explain why when you're in the Champion and we've got this conflict between Bennett and Cochrane, why is it that Bennett's saying, look, dude, you are not thinking straight?
Yeah.
And Cochrane's saying, that's irrelevant. I'm the captain. Da, 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 da. And we had to have this conflict. And I knew it was coming up in the Champion. And I knew I was writing it in. And so I thought, I need to express this backstory so that when my readers read that part, they're not lost. Mm-hmm. You know, what's the story? Why is Cochrane just nutsoid? I mean, why did she go bonkers here? And so I needed to express that. And not to spoil a lot of things, but The Last Night of the Year plays big also in The Lark and the Nightingale. So
okay,
that's going to be coming up too. We're going to get more of that.
Now, it's kind of left open-ended. Her, at that time, husband, are they still married? That's not really spelled out in or is that what gets spelled out later?
That's
on?
What gets spelled out in
okay.
The Lark.
Okay. Okay.
Right. Quit jumping ahead.
I don't know.
It's really funny. So So I always talk about my muse as if it's an entity.
Uh-huh.
It should.
And
be.
I like ask my muse questions, and my muse sometimes just won't tell me.
Right.
I have oft asked my muse, are they still married?
Right.
And my muse says, I don't know. I'm not talking to you. And I'm like, thanks. So
maybe actually, that's an answer right there. Maybe they're not. No.
Well, and that's the thing. We didn't – and actually I had to come up with a definitive answer for The Lark and the Nightingale. So it's coming up soon in the story.
Okay,
in fact,
cool.
I think it's going to be coming up in probably – I think late February or early March.
Oh, great.
That's where we're going. So
great. So you get to that backstory because she was only an ensign or something at that point where when we see her in Last Night of the Year. So she obviously you're seeing a younger Cochrane at that point.
With much shorter hair.
Yeah. Yeah. And the colors that you use in that, now was that what kind of markers were you using for that? Because that's definitely different than what you did before.
Yeah, those are Copic markers.
Okay.
At the time, I was actually in Japan. I was in Japan from 2006 to 2009 teaching English in junior high.
Wow.
Which was a wonderful experience, and I recommend it for everybody. You should go abroad if you can, because it's wonderful. But at the time, so there's a little place called there's an art store called Joyful Honda. I'm not kidding, because it's Japan and everything is adorable, and even their names are adorable.
Okay,
and every so often they would have sales on Copic markers.
Yeah.
And I was like, oh, you know what? I need to learn to do something in color. I can't just always stay in black and white.
Right.
But they would have these Copics. So I just go in and buy them when they were on sale. And they were, you know, I get a pack of like four or five of them for about 500 yen, which is about $5.
Okay.
Which is an astonishing deal if you have ever bought Copic markers.
Okay.
Because they're usually about $7 a pop.
Wow. Wow.
So they go on these like, you know, they just run them out. Well, the other thing that was wonderful about Joyful Honda is it would have Zip-A-Tone, mm-hmm. which are the dot tones that you see, the dot patterns you see in my comic.
Yeah.
And so I'd buy the Zip-A-Tones and I'd buy all this stuff and I'd scan the Zip-A-Tones in. And then whenever I'm done with my drawing, my line work, I'd overlay the Zip-A-Tone scans and then just trim them out so that I don't have to waste my Zip-A-Tone.
Right, right.
But that's how I do all of that. That was Copic marker for the last end of the year.
Wow, it's beautiful. Very well done.
And it's also thank you. And it's also the same for the very first pages of Champion. It's also Copic.
Yeah, I noticed that in the beginning there that it has that. So obviously the Zip-A-Tone is the same effect we see, especially in more 80s, 90s manga comics. Mm-hmm. We see that a lot. They kind of gone away from that in some manga now because I think a lot of it's computer. They can do all that stuff. So that's not as big as it used to be. But that was definitely a thing for a long time. So, so that's really great. So so all of that come together. You do the Tamerlan. And now, did you get – obviously you said you had a message board and you had a lot of people giving you feedback. How was that feedback? I mean, was it all good or was it just back and forth or is it 50-50 or –
Well, and the message board is still alive somehow out there. I don't know how, but there are still people who visit it. Mm-hmm. It's on Tamerlan, USSTamerlan.com. It's just got a little message board up there at the top. Most of the feedback was very positive.
Cool.
I did get one interesting thing that I, and you kind of, it wasn't a negative feedback, but it really put me into a kind of a throw. One of the guys that I was talking to at the time on the message board, once Champion was completely done and out there, he said, well, I really liked it, but I had one problem with it. And I was like, uh-oh, what? And he said, well, you talk about how you're trying to be very peaceful and not have a violent ending for everything, but your resolution for Champion wasn't exactly what I construe as peaceful. And I thought about that, and I was like, oh, no, I didn't think about that.
Right.
And so it sort of set me – and so if you read The Lark and the Nightingale, you sort of see an allusion to that. There's a, you know, we're starting out with Dottrell and Cochrane talking in a forward room on Tamerlan, and that's what she's sort of talking about is the, you know, do you still have problems with what happened with the Champion?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
And she's alluding to it, and that's what she's, and then what had happened was, and this is another one of those you should always reread before you start laying down inks, because over the, you know, he wrote that in 09, and it's been quite a few years since 09,
uh-huh.
And over the years, my memory of what he said sort of evolved to.
It turned something bigger.
Yeah, it evolved to Cochrane's response was not. I didn't think that was an appropriate response for Cochrane.
Right.
Then I went back and reread it after I had already written the script and laid down the inks for the first issue, and I reread it, and he was like, no, I just felt that you, Guy, were trying to do heading a different way with the story, and this was a resolution.
Right.
I felt she was doing fine. It was you, and he was referring to me personally, and I was like, oh, okay. So we get kind of a weird blip between the first one and the second one. Because then if you read what the next issue or next week's version, which for you guys will be, you know, in a couple of days, but for everybody else will already have been out there for a while. But the next issue along, Dottrell just sidesteps it. He's just like, okay, whatever.
Yeah. He doesn't really
go on to the plot.
Doesn't say much about it. Right.
And he just sidestep it. So, but I never really got like, I hate this or anything. I did get into a really weird argument once with a guy who was telling me that I was using a very weird or a very misogynistic trope.
How do you mean? Like, for, explain that a little further.
Really?
So, yeah, that's exactly what I said. I said, did you read my comic? So he was saying that there's a misogynistic trope called the beautiful body or the beautiful. Anyway, it starts out with the detectives show up and a naked woman who's dead.
Oh, right, I gotcha.
And they have to figure out why.
Right.
And it's using the woman as an object. So it's misogynistic. Well, I mean, you know, you call me misogynistic and like. Sets off my little like fight thing because I hate misogyny. It's one of the things. It's one of the compelling reasons why I tell stories that are female led.
Gotcha.
And so I was like, what? Wait, oh no! And we went back and forth, and I don't know. I think he must have read just the first issue and saw the Champion, you know, on the slave ship.
And
took that as the trope.
Right.
I said, but she's got her agency. She's got domain. She's in control.
Yeah.
And she almost blows up the ship.
And she almost blows up the ship. It's not like
we're pretty really, much does, actually.
She really does blow up the ship.
But people are still alive, so that's
takes out engineering, takes out the warp nacelle. Oh, it really was not a pretty day.
No. It was a bad day.
That's what you get with a smaller ship and a person who's a bomb.
Yeah, exactly.
Human bomb.
So I don't know what that was all about, and I still don't quite understand. I've gone back and reread that whole argument, and it breaks my heart because he's a fellow artist who writes Star Trek comics too, and he was just like, I'm done with you. And I'm like, okay.
Huh. You know, it's that stinks.
I know. It really felt bad. I really felt awful.
So that's the other thing is like we don't see too much on our Synthetic Facebook page, but there does seem to be this huge like infighting with Star Trek fans. It's like, you know, like, who's the purest fan? What's the purest essence of Star Trek? I mean, if you're talking about the J.J.
Only the 60 show.
Only the 60 that's, show.
That's the only Star Trek. Yeah, I mean, can't do anything.
Did you run into that at all? Like, people like, you know, what is this? This isn't canon, or this is, you know, you're just making up. I mean, did you get a lot of the nitpickers like that or anything like that? Or did people let a lot of that stuff fly? Like, they didn't go into it with you.
Yeah, I haven't run into that a whole lot. Okay. Luckily, I'm kind of glad because I wear my heart on my sleeve, and I don't know how much I'd take with the, you know,
the browbeating.
I don't know how much browbeating I could take. So it's kind of I worry about that. But yeah, I mean, I haven't run into a whole lot of negative feedback okay. so far. But I'm also not that far out there. I'm sure that there's going to have to come a time. I know it's just a matter of time because I'm going to start putting these out regularly. People are going to start coming in. It's only a matter of time before I run into more people who, you know, either they're going to – if they come at me with the you shouldn't have a female captain, I'm ready for that. Right. You know, I'm ready for that fight. But if they come at me with, you know, I hate your drawing style or – you know, your drawing style sucks or stuff like that. I don't know what I'll do with that.
Yeah, you get that. I mean, there's definitely trolls out there that like to just like beat up on you for nothing.
I mean, some people just hate anime because it's like it's not American or maybe it's just because of, I don't know. I don't understand like the some people irrationally hate like manga anime, and I just don't understand.
That doesn't make why. A lot of sense either.
Yeah, it does seem like that. It seems like there's I don't know.
It's kind of like some people irrationally hate Apple for like no reason other than it's popular. It's like, oh, it's too popular, so I'm just going to dislike it because I don't want to be like those people.
Right. Contrarians kind of thing. Yeah. Because
it's versus PC.
Yeah, no, but it seems like there's a lot of things like that. So I just wonder if you ran into that because you have been outputting your comic for a while, and I'm sure there's always going to be people who are going to just like, you know, give you shit because it's not what they think it should be or whatever.
Hopefully, all our five listeners will give you all the all the love that they give us.
I see.
You're killing me.
I do my best.
He's killing me slowly, guy. Save me. That's great. I mean, glad that you didn't run into that because I think anything, especially when you're in infancy of any kind of creation, you do need to have that little moral support that you're not like just out in the middle of the woods and you're just like, you know, I hope these breadcrumbs don't get eaten, you know, kind of thing.
I feel like that's how we're still kind of like. Like we haven't gotten any like really negative feedback, but I mean, we get a little bit like, you know, things here and there, but I mean, it's not like a huge outpouring of support and not a huge and nothing as far as anything negative yet.
Yeah.
But we're just waiting.
Well, you guys are, you know, you're also in kind of a little bit of a different medium. You're doing a podcast where you're going to say controversial things, be it, you know, oh, I like J.J. Abrams. J.J. Abrams or whatever. That's going to, you know.
Yeah, I'm here to say controversial things, and he's here to try to set me straight, usually.
Yeah, Dave will say things.
No, I try to be bigger on canon than he's like, oh, you're talking about canon. We're talking about making a drinking game where if I mention canon, like someone's got to take a drink.
Dave's big on the canon thing.
So I think we get along great, guy.
I think canon's awesome. Canon's bendable.
I think it is too. And I've got strange ideas about it.
Yes.
Well, and I try to work really hard to work within canon because I find that to be a challenge.
Yeah.
One of the things, I mean, you know, we know that Turnabout Intruder, the last episode of TOS, was about, you know, Janice Lester saying, I can't be a Star Trek or I can't be a Starship captain because I'm a woman.
Right.
Well, most people just eject that from the canon.
Right.
And so I've worked kind of to say, it's not a starship. Tamerlan's a destroyer.
Right.
And so to imply that the Big 13 are sort of like a boys' club. And so that, you know, and even then I'm trying to kind of shoehorn canon to still work.
Right.
Most people on the forum said, don't bother. Nobody actually pays attention.
No one, so I think Turnabout Intruder was always kind of ignored.
It's kind of ignored because it is kind of really misogynistic there. But
I don't dislike the episode itself. I just think at the end it's just like, what?
Well, I mean, like my view
on, going with it. Yeah,
my view on canon, like I like to stick to it as much as I can. But if Star Trek doesn't reference itself, I'd say it's fair game to not be canon.
Right.
It doesn't reference it. Back in.
Because, I mean, like, I mean, you know, if it's supposedly canon that females can't be captain until Janeway, but, I mean, if you look at, you know, what, Star Trek 4. You have a female.
The Saratoga.
Yeah, the female captain of the Saratoga. So that's only, like, you know.
Enterprise,
like
you have
15 years, or maybe not even 15 years after the original series is over, as far as like time.
Enterprise,
well,
has,
yeah, but the Columbia.
It has Columbia,
right.
has a female captain. I think that was just an odd. I think
60s mentality.
I mean, I know what they're trying to go at there, but it was still like, I don't know. So,
if you read about how Roddenberry did things, he was a big fan of Jonathan Swift, who wrote Gulliver's Travels.
Okay. Yeah.
And what he loved about Gulliver's Travels was, if you read Gulliver's Travels, you think it's about little people tying up Gulliver. And what it's really about is it's about the Church of England. The whole book is whining and complaining about the Church of England. And it's because back then you'd be killed if you wrote the Church of England sucks.
Gotcha.
So instead he wrote Gulliver's Travels, mm-hmm. which is an analogy for the Church of England. So Roddenberry was really big on that, and that's why a lot of his stories are, like Let This Be Your Last Battlefield, are not direct statements. Or,
sure.
You know, we've got all of those that he was talking about Vietnam over and over and over again,
right?
A number of episodes. And, you know, that's one of the charm and the beauty of Star Trek in general. So I try to do something similar, but I think that with Turnabout Intruder specifically, that was after Roddenberry had left, and after we'd lost Gene Kuhn, and even I think Meredith Lucas was gone at that point in time too. So we were already like at like the third or fourth string producers, mm-hmm. and the budget was being cut, and they had moved the show to Friday night where nobody was watching it, and you know, they were dying.
Death's
they were dying on the vine. So nobody watched it. And they're like, you know what we should do? We should do a thing about complaining about women. And Dorothy Fontana, of course, was like, hey, this is a good idea. And then somebody else wrote it. And I don't think Dorothy really appreciated the episode.
I don't think
either.
Yeah, I wouldn't. I mean, I was going to ask if she was still involved at that point, because I'm like, I didn't think she would take that too kindly.
Yeah.
I haven't read Mark Cushman's book on season three yet. I'm still in the These Are the Voyages.
Yeah, I've got all three. I'm still in the first one.
I'm in the second one, so I haven't gotten to that one. I'm curious as to what's going to happen.
And I can't read. That's why I like his comics. I just look at the pictures.
That's why we just talk. We don't read nothing.
I don't read. So that's I mean, obviously, there's original series. Original series is king in my book, but there is a lot of obviously problems with it, because they were cobbling together a lot of ideas. I don't think they had a clear map of where they're going. I mean, by the time we got Next Generation, we started to have a better idea where they wanted to be.
Well, and on your talk with Larry, you know, he was talking about how, like, in between, before that, he started kind of, like, putting things together, like, and that was, you know, considered canon, like, how to, like, you know, piece out how things started to work. So, I mean, really, like, things didn't start, like, becoming cohesive until, like, pre-Next Generation, really.
Yeah. Well, it was the fans who took it on, you know, like Larry and like the name just walked right out of my brain.
The Akutas?
I'm sorry?
The Akutas?
No, the Akutas came in later. I was with the series. Oh, I'll think of it later. And it'll hit me like when we're talking about something completely
Ashley Judge.
Ashley Judge. Yes.
It was Ashley Judge.
She's the mastermind behind The Next Generation. She wanted to kiss Will Wheaton so bad. That's why she got cast.
Didn't want to kiss Guy.
No.
Could have been wearing that sweater kissing Ashley Judge.
Older.
Yeah, could have been kissing Ashley Judd.
Those 2 days.
Could have been kissing Ashley Judd. Think about it.
That would have been.
And on screen. Yeah, and it's forever immortalized. And now in Blu-ray high definition.
That's something you put on your resume.
Kissed Ashley Judd.
There were a lot of people who were really working hard to kind of drum up Star Trek in the 70s, in the very, very early 70s.
Yeah.
And they were putting together the pieces of the universe, like Franz Joseph and the Technical Manual. So I think that what we got is we didn't actually get like a cohesive part of Star Trek until after it went off the air. I don't think it actually gelled up. They didn't know what they had when they started it. It's not, you know, they didn't, they had no idea. You listen to what William Shatner says about being cast versus, say, Patrick Stewart. You know, when Patrick Stewart's being cast, they're like, well, we're not sure it's going to last, but you do know that this is a Star Trek, right? You know?
Yeah.
And, right. and you know, he didn't know what it meant, but he, you know, people, and after that, you listen to how they, you know, Avery Brooks talk about it or Kate Mulgrew, and how they're being cast in like this. So it's, they didn't know what they had.
Right.
So I think we get a lot of weird errors in the first one, and some of them you can eject, and I mean, there's some parts that I just have to, I'm sorry, the two warp nacelle thing, I can try to work with that, but you know,
I mean, I don't think that even though they tried to make it canon, I really don't think they can. The Klingon bird of prey has zero nacelles.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, it just
causes it to warp around.
I mean, like, you know, I mean, the wings are just like articulate so you could shoot phasers at different angles. I mean, there's no.
You don't really need the wings there. Other than maybe going through atmosphere. I don't know.
I mean, yeah. I mean, all they do is articulate for different firing positions.
Yeah.
And then you've got the red, you know, engine on the back, which, I mean, usually the red engine is always an impulse engine. So I guess it's a combo. But I mean, that's only one nacelle, if you can call it that. So I mean,
I'm guessing that the warp engines must be inside somewhere.
Yeah,
you know, like super hazardous. You know, it's like because Klingons don't care.
They're all gonna die.
Cancer is a glorious way to die.
You'll be dead before they metastasize.
because you'll pick a fight with someone because you've got some bacteria on your ship. It's like, he put bacteria on my ship. I want to kill him.
That's right. Well, you got to do that. Yeah. I kill anybody who put bacteria on me.
Exactly.
Uh-oh.
Murder!
I just put some bacteria on Aaron. I touched his shoulder.
Sip your pants up.
Okay. Not with that! I need an adult.
Just so you guys know, I have them on Skype, and that was a horrible sight.
we have blinded our guests. You will never be able to draw a thing again. maybe his wife can help.
We've ruined another poor soul.
Poor soul. So, I was looking at your Facebook page for the Tamlin this morning, and you said you were working with 3D and you moved to another one. I did see you actually answered my question on there. If you could answer it again, and then also like on the air, and also like when did you start working with 3D with the comic? Because that interests me.
Yeah, it actually. So one of the things I noticed was that early on drawing the Tamlin took 10 times longer than drawing Captain Cochrane.
Sucks.
Because I can't draw circles to save my life. And apparently,
see?
It's like, I don't know what the deal was, but I draw the dish and then I have to erase it. And then I draw the dish and it would look like it was lopsided and it would look like, and I was like, this is seriously starting to irritate me.
Right.
And I had been using Poser at the time to get just like pre-poses. I don't know what. You know, I can't visualize how this. So I'd pose something on Poser and then just sketch it on on the table and while looking at the monitor. Mm-hmm. And that was you know, sort of. And so I'd been using Poser for a long time, and then somebody somewhere along the line had a model of the Saladin class. Wow. And so I downloaded that, and then I brought it up, and that helped so much to bring it up on screen and do that. And I thought, this is really useful. I wonder if I could just render it pure and do that. But I don't want to render somebody else's model because that's not their art, or that's not my art. So I actually then learned how to use a program called Animator, which was A-N-I-M and then the number 8 and then O-R, because this was back in the early days. And I started to build a Saladin class off of the blueprints so that it was my Saladin, so that, you know, the model is mine. And I, you know, because I feel very strongly about the way artists, you know, I don't want to use anybody else's stuff.
Right.
And and then play it off as mine. Yeah. And I was like, it felt at the time like I was cheating a little bit anyway by using 3D. But then I started to hand draw I didn't hand draw. I drew in a CAD, well, not a CAD program, in Photoshop. I did the circles and all that stuff, and I did all the detailing on the model. And I was like, well, I drew this all myself, and it's my own design. And The Tamerlan has some small little details that are different than the other Saladins, because it's, if you go to the real Navy and you look at the ships, even from each, like, Ashley Burke destroyer, from one to the next, there are little differences between them.
Yeah.
And so, the Tamerlan has an interesting, like, for example, the windows in the front of the dish are slightly different than all of the other ships. And I did that on purpose to give it some distinction so that she looks different.
Yeah.
But I did all of that, and I drew it all up, and I built it in Animator, and then I imported the models into Poser, and then I render them in Poser, render them flat, I usually just render them flat with no shadowing. And then sometimes I'll go in with shadows in Photoshop, and then sometimes I'll put the Zip-a-tone on there, and put the use the Zip-tone to shadow the ship. But either way, and then with the newest versions, I've actually been doing sets that way too.
That's great.
Yeah. And it helps me a lot because Cochrane is really small and Dottrell is really tall. And so what I've got these like sticks that I have that are Cochrane sized and Dottrell sized. And I'll stick them in the stupid set so that I won't, because there have been so many times that I had to erase both of them.
Yeah.
Because he's supposed to tower over
her. He's a big guy.
And she's a little person.
Yeah.
And so, he's supposed to be huge. And there were these times where I'd draw them and I realized that their heads were level with one another. And I'm like, yeah, no, I did it wrong. And I'd have to erase one or the other of them.
Wow.
So now I've got these little marker sticks that I put in there. It says, this is Cochrane and this is Dottrell. And stop making Cochrane too tall and stop making Dottrell too short.
That's great.
Do you do all your drawing like traditionally, or do you like use a drawing pad in like Photoshop to do them?
A little of both. And especially with Lark and the Nightingale. Because like the first issue was done all on Manga Studio. I use Manga Studio 5, and I have a Microsoft Surface, and I even have a little stylus that I use and stuff like that. I just, by the way, for those of you at home, I just showed my stylus to the camera. I could show my Surface to the camera too.
I'm sure I have a Huey and drawing pad. I'm trying to learn how to like draw.
Oh, I loves it. It's beautiful. That's great. But I'm still having a problem with the glass. It's too smooth. It doesn't have enough.
It doesn't have any friction when you pull across.
Right. And I've got this really nice bamboo stylus that has a rubber nib. Mm-hmm. So it drags a little, which is great. But it still doesn't feel the same as pen and paper. So the first issue of the Lark and the Nightingale was done all in Manga Studio. The second one is done on an actual 11x17 Bristol board.
Okay.
Oh, nice.
So,
because I draw on a Bristol board, 11x17 myself. Dave keeps on trying to get me to use a
drawing pad. I'm trying to get used to. I abandoned paper completely. I used to draw at my old job where I used to write obituaries in between obituaries, and I'd love the feel of like a sharp, very very sharp pencil on paper. But since I have a degree in game design and I want to do like digital art eventually as a job, digital art, I mean, I might as well just like, make myself learn how it feels. And it feels so weird and so wrong on a drawing pad as opposed to pencil and paper. But
the trees love him, though. He's right. Popular with the trees.
Yeah, the trees.
He's got a big following in the tree community.
Well, and there's a certain amount of complication to it. I mean, with 11x17, you have to get an 11x17 scanner and printer.
Yeah.
Which is expensive.
Or,
I just bought
one.
Or flip.
I just bought one.
Or flip.
Also, the power of Control Z is a wonderful thing, and not having to take extra time to erase things.
So I was drawing a picture the other day on paper, and I made a mistake, and I reached up to my keyboard and hit Control Z. Imagine to my surprise when the pencil did not, in fact, disappear.
Mm.
It's so annoying, right? Yeah. So yeah, like
I also just recently did this. I bought a glove and then cut all the fingers but the pinky off. Because my touch screen on the tablet, I would constantly be drawing, and as soon as my pen came up, my palm would detect, and it would draw a line right there where my mom was. So that's what this is all about. I just bought this, and so now I have like this weird Michael Jackson glove, which I've got, which has got just the pinky.
You need more rhinestones on there.
No. I was noticing it's got this like bizarre, but it does have like this
bizarre
pattern.
Yeah, it does. I couldn't see it there. Yeah. So he's showing a black glove, everything.
It's very textured on the bottom.
The pinky only left on. He's cut off all the other fingers. Fingers are intact, and he does.
At first, I thought he was missing his pinky.
But there is a thing about that. I mean, I'm trying to get to it, but I'm totally with you, Aaron. I am. I mean, it's hard. It's a hard conversion. I've been drawing on paper since 1991 thereabouts.
Yeah.
And so it's really hard. I remember the first time that I was drawing my comic, Dokuko's Angel, and my friend said, I don't know, it just doesn't look, the detail doesn't look that good. And so he said, wait a second. And he took my page as I was drawing, which is 8.5 by 11, and took it over to his photocopier, because we were at his office, and he shrunk it down. And the detail looked so awesome.
Yeah.
And that was the first time we realized, oh, they must draw it on big paper.
Yeah.
And so I went to, like, at the time I went to Kinko's, you know, because that was back when Kinko's still existed.
Yeah.
And I had them run off a whole bunch of 11 by 17s with these lines drawn in it. So I could then shrink it. But then I had to go back to Kinko's all the time and have them shrink it, because nobody had an 11 by 17 scanner or photocopier back then, except Kinko's.
Yeah, yeah.
But yeah, I've been drawing on traditional media for a very, very long time. But, you know, David's right. I mean, the truth is the power of Control Z compels me. It is so nice to be able to just say, oops, I just inked that really badly. Control Z.
That's honestly, that's my biggest thing, because I can pencil till the cows come home. But when it comes to inking, it literally, it's my bane. I can do it. I enjoy doing when I do it well, but sometimes you really mess that up.
Well, I mean, inking like the digital pad feels different than a pencil. So, like, I miss drawing with a pencil, but I know I need to make my craft and I need to do it on digital pad, because that's just, it's just going to be easier in the long run if I make myself do it this way.
Maybe sooner or later I will make that transition. I'm usually the last person to give in. So
give in.
I wish I could afford one of those, like, you know, $2,000 like ones with a screen on it, so you don't have, I don't have to like draw down and look up drawing, because that's also strange. That's a strange disconnect between like a drawing pad I have that's just like a black canvas, and you're drawing, but you're looking up at the screen and not down at where your hand is.
There's a great, I think it's a two-part documentary. I mean, each documentary thing is like about like 15 minutes long on YouTube, about the artist Frank Quitely, and he's got one of those. I mean, this thing is so cool. It's just a giant glass screen, and he's drawing his comic on it. It's like, I'm like, oh my god, this guy. So amazing.
If it wasn't for the fact that those things are $3,000-$4,000.
Oh, yeah.
And, you know, it's like, and that's, and even with those, they've got 10 point touch. Mm-hmm. So you're going to have to use the glove, you know, because otherwise you are totally going to keep writing all over the stupid thing with your palm.
Right.
And they do really good. I mean, they work on palm rejection and work on palm rejection. I keep going, you know, I just want a Cintiq that doesn't have touch.
Mm-hmm.
And they're like, oh, why would you want that? I'm like, because I scribble all over it with my palm.
Yeah.
It's like having a big pencil that's your hand.
Right.
And it's like, you know. So I don't know. I mean, it's kind of difficult in that way.
I kind of want to get an iPad Pro, because the pencil, it's supposed to, like, it's got different detectors in it than the one on your hand. So if you're in a drawing program, it knows that the pencil is needed, not your hand. So like, I think it basically turns off, like, hand touch whenever you use the Apple Pencil on the iPad Pro. I kind of want to get one of those, but I never like getting a first gen Apple product. So maybe a year.
Yeah, you might want to wait a year. The palm rejection is in like the Surface, but I draw and then I'll lift up the pen like this. You know, I'll pull the pen up quite a ways, and then that's just far enough for the Wacom sensor to say, oh, he's switched off of pen mode and into touch mode. And so, oh, his palm is touching. So we will now open the Windows thing and switch all of his tools over and then shut the machine down. And I'm like, oh, come on. Seriously?
Oh, that's nice. Yeah.
So it's one of those things. I've got solutions for it, but it's irritating that I have to wear a glove to draw now.
And I complain about cleaning my ink brushes every time I ink. I hate cleaning those because you got to get the soap and water, and you got to make sure it's all rinsed out. No, I'm not going to bore people with that. So
you already did. No.
We can talk shop. It's great.
Sorry, guy.
So the Tamberlin, you're coming up with this new storyline. Is this going to be a longer story, or is this a short story? Do you have this kind of planned out, or do you just kind of let it flow on its own?
Seven seasons.
Yep. This is the long arc. Okay. So I have been rolling into this for a while. Every one of these has been a little test. Uh-huh. You know, the 12 pages were to test to see if I had the wherewithal to stick to it.
Right.
And then the Champion was my full size comic to see whether I was ever able to go 180 pages.
Yeah.
This is my long arc. I've been planning this for a long, long time. We're going to resolve all the characters at the end of this arc. Wow. I've been setting up. There's a prose story that was in a magazine a while back, which was Bennett's backstory. Because originally Bennett was a science officer.
Okay.
And the fact that she's now a security officer there's a story behind it. And the fact that she's got one brown eye and one green eye and that shock of gray hair.
She got kind of blown up, right? I mean, that's...
She did, yeah.
Something that's happened exactly to her. What happened.
She was doing too much
more
science.
More accurately, she got blown out.
Okay.
Because that was what really happened. She was on the USS Diana, which was a scout.
Okay.
Doing science, and then the bridge got breached, and she was blown into space.
Gotcha.
And so there's a story about that. It's all prose, so I'm going to have to do something, maybe a storybook, a la The Last Night of the Year.
Okay.
Where I explain that back in, because there's many people have read that prose piece, and I even think I've got the prose piece on my site. And if not, I will. Okay. But it's you know it's. It was a somebody wanted me to do a short story for their compilation, but they didn't do comics, so they were like, "Can you do prose?" And I'm like, "Oh, sure, I'll write it up as a prose," and that was great.
Yeah.
But it's going to resolve that story. There's a 6-panel piece that I did on Ward's background, but I put it only out in the forum, and then that forum was destroyed. So this is before this new forum. Okay. We've already gone through 2 iterations of this forum.
Wow.
But there was another five panel sort of background of Ward on the planet Jericho. So all of these are going to expand out and link up. We've got, you know, so I intend to go on ahead and run all of them to the end.
Okay. Great. That's great that we're going to get these background, these stories. I mean, because we got a little bit on Cochran, her background. But I, like you said, Bennett doesn't, you don't really know what happened to her. Why she is the way she is, and then, like you said, Ward has got the jack that she can put in, but she doesn't really, you know. She said she had a troubled past. That's all, like, you know,
a
troubled past.
I think she called herself a rat net or net rat or something
net
like
rat.
That. Yeah, mm-hmm. Yeah, something to that nature. Yeah. So that's a little bit different. So yeah, I mean, they're all interesting characters, and I like that you have these background stories that are kind of already kind of figured out in your head. Just we haven't seen it or been revealed to us yet. So that's cool. So there's a lot to learn for that.
I've got a lot to catch up on.
Yeah. No, it's going to be great. I'm excited because this is a. I mean, the thing is. What I really love about what you do is, I mean, obviously I love the art, I love the stories, but I love the passion that you just gone out and you just keep on creating, and you're putting this stuff out in the world. And, you know, for people like me to read, they'd be like, wow, this is cool. And this guy, he did all these pages? Like, what
by
are you?
Himself?
Yeah, he's like, you know, he's like, this, oh, man. He must have, like, you know, no life whatsoever. Just to you.
It's almost true. when I was in Japan, I had all these like between periods in classes, and they were like, it's all right, we've got it under control, and they didn't want me to do anything, so I sat at my desk all day, and I didn't know what to do. So, I bought a motion computing M1400 tablet. which is one of the early prototype tablets. They use them for medical, usually, so that they've got a pen that you could actually write with.
Right.
And I bought that, and I brought it into the classroom, into the teacher's room every day, and drew on these comics because I had nothing to do, you know. And then there were, it was Japan, so they've got all these like weird rules, like they've got what they called undokai, which is a I don't know what we would call it. It's a physical exercise. Lots of people would go out and do, I guess we'd call it field day. But they would compete. All the classes would compete. Well, I don't know what to do there. So they're like, okay, well, you can sit in the teacher's room and, you know, here's some tea. And I'm like, okay. So I've got 3 days of sitting in the teacher's room all day.
Wow.
And that happened a lot. I loved being there, but, you know, they didn't know what to do with an American, you know. There,
right.
At the time, I didn't speak very good Japanese, and so it's not like I could hang out with anybody but the English teachers. That was the only teachers I could hang out with.
Gotcha. Yeah.
So I really did have a lot of time on my hands to draw those.
That's great.
That's time.
It's great time that you can, like, you know, get into that and invest that time in your imagination. For all that, and it, I mean, it really just shows. I mean, there's just so, it's such a, you know, robust, you know, little universe you created there. So that's great. I really enjoyed it. I just can't wait to see what else you come up with and what else we're going to see from you. Obviously, like I said, we're going to post all your information onto the site, and, you know, that everyone can, you know, see your comic and give to the Patreon. Again, I'm just going to give it again. So it's USSTamberlin.com, or you can go to the Facebook.com/USTamberlin, or go to the www.patreon.com, and G.S. Davis Art is his Patreon. So,
well, and yeah, I mean, you're obviously a big Star Trek fan, as we've talked about this whole time, and you're putting your time and effort into doing this amazing comic. Just like a month or so ago, month and a half ago, you know, CBS announced a new Star Trek series. Like, what do you, we did a whole episode for our kind of hopes and dreams on it, but what are your thoughts and hopes and dreams on this as an avid Star Trek fan? Like,
they pick up, like, the USS Tamberlin.
Yes.
Give him a lots of dump truck of money.
Yes, give me a dump truck of money and pick up my ship, and that'd be fine. I don't know. It's kind of one of those things. With each iteration, I was on the wave of, I don't know, I don't like this Voyager one. And then it was, I don't know, I don't like this Enterprise one. But then now it's been a decade, and I've been going back and rewatching them in sequence. Mm-hmm. And they're not bad. I really like them now. I mean, now that I'm not, I don't know, maybe I was just too full of myself. I have no earthly idea.
I'm same like with music. Like, I'm just like understanding the Beatles. I'm just,
yeah,
I'm joking.
Yeah, exactly.
No, but I mean,
all you need is love and Beatles.
Oh, wait.
No, but I mean, it's like, I sometimes you see things and you don't, it's not what you're familiar with. You're like, ah, what is that? You know, and then later on you come back like, oh, that was actually pretty good.
Really wasn't bad. I mean, you know, once Janeway let her hair down, literally, she was actually a much better character. And I liked her a lot more. Part of the genesis of Cochrane came from Janeway, because, you know, when Janeway first came out, all of us were like, seriously, what? They have to make her butch?
Yeah.
I mean, she doesn't have to go beating on people. She could be just a normal character. And that's the whole point behind Cochrane. She's just a normal Joe. I mean, you know, I don't make her rough and tumble. I don't make her super strong. She doesn't have to whip her crew into shape. They know who's the captain of the ship. She knows she's the captain of the ship. It's fine.
Right, right.
Everything's cool.
Yeah.
And so she can be just her. And like third season or so with a Voyager, Janeway started to let her hair down, and she was a much more approachable character, and I liked it a lot better. And I think I was put off by those first two seasons where she was all rough and tumble, and I can be just as mean as any other male captain, which I didn't feel was necessary.
I didn't think so either, but I mean, I've discussed this a couple of times. I just feel like the writers didn't know what to do with her. They were scared to, like,
I think they
stereotype
had, like,
her, yeah, they and, had, and as a vulnerable, emotional person, because everyone's has vulnerabilities and emotions. But this is the first woman, so we can't make her emotional. We can't make her vulnerable. Yeah. We can't do anything with her that would make her look weak. So we're going to write about other characters.
Right. Because
that's what it kind of felt like. She was like she's supposed to be the lead, but like, you know, 7 of 9 came, and then like, you know, when she came, it was like every episode that was really good was the 7 of 9 or Doctor episode, which, yep. I mean, I love those two characters, and I'm glad they were really good episodes, but I just felt like a lot of the main cast kind of fell away, and you didn't get any episodes about them as often because, I mean, like, they were the best two, like, I've said a couple times, like, the best three written characters in the show are the Doctor, 7 of 9, and Naomi Wildman.
Yep.
Best written characters on the show.
And yeah, they've got the most background too.
Yeah, and I think you're is exactly what it is. I think they were just like the writers and the producers were just scared shitless of how are you going to portray a woman, first woman captain? You don't want to make her soft and feminine. You can't make her too, you know, masculine. So, you know, it's like you got to write this tightrope, and it's like, why can't she just be a character, like a human? And I think I think the writing for her suffered a lot because of that, because we never got a lot of the backstories that we should have gotten for her, you know, especially for that long of a run of a show, you know. I mean, oh. we got a ton from Picard and Archer. I mean, Kirk was a little short because it was, you know, only
a short show.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But I mean, even Sisko, we got a ton of backstory.
And like, you know, he's half alien, half fourth dimensional being.
Right.
Like, oh, wow, well, how does that work?
Loves baseball.
Baseball. Jake, let's go play some baseball and make a sail ship.
Okay. And when I wrote Cochrane, I purposely put in these scenes where she would get stressed out to the point of tears and she would be really pressed. But then she'd turn around and say, okay, here's what we're going to do.
Right.
And here's how we're going to handle it.
Right.
She's a human. Right. She's a human being. She's got her pluses and her minuses. And I really liked that. And I wanted to, in a way, I kind of wrote her to be you can write a character who's human and is female and doesn't have to be butch and doesn't have to be super strong. So Janeway is part of the impetus for the design of Cochrane in that way.
Right.
As for what I'm hoping for it's Kurtzman who's doing the new series. I'm hoping that he takes care of it. But, you know, I always worry about it takes care of the canon, takes care of, you know, cultivates this a little bit. I know that they've got to make them faster. I know that they've got to make them more explodey, more Michael Bay. I understand that, and I appreciate that. And I'm really hoping, Simon Pegg, I'm really counting on you, man. I'm hoping that Star Trek Beyond is finally getting back to the moral plays and to the Jonathan Swift-esque stories, which is what Roddenberry was really after. And Simon Pegg is an old school Trekkie like me, and so I have a lot of faith now that Simon's involved in that. You know, I've got a lot more faith in him, even though I'm not so sure about the director. Sure. But you know, J.J. Abrams wasn't a Trekkie, and he said it from the outset. He wasn't a Trekkie. He's a Star Wars fan. It's clear.
Yeah.
It's clear he's a Star Wars fan.
Those two movies are like almost a resume for The Force Awakens.
Yeah. I know. Yeah. Totally was. And really, honestly, the first Star Trek, the 09 Star Trek, wasn't bad. I liked it. It was okay.
Mm-hmm.
I really wish they hadn't gone to Khan. I really think that was a mistake in Into Darkness.
Yeah.
I think Khan would have been fine if they would have, like, you know, kept going with the original idea where he was like, you know, where like Marcus was the bad guy and they kind of had to team up. If they kept that through the whole film,
I just don't think
would have been fine.
I just don't think they needed the Wrath of Khan callbacks at all.
Which is how you would avoid the Wrath of Khan callbacks by having Khan stay, you know, like dubious buddy of Kirk instead of like just turn him out into the real bad guy instead of Marcus.
I just think that, you know, the first maybe 3/4 of the Into Darkness is pretty good. I mean, there's a couple issues, but the ending is just like, what?
What? Yeah. Spock's beating on him? Hello?
Yeah.
Although, like, you know, a lot of Star Trek fans complain about, you know, how derivative Into Darkness is of Wrath of Khan, but like Force Awakens is way more derivative of A New Hope than In the Darkness was of Wrath of Khan.
Yeah. Well, they're both the hero's journey, the classic hero's journey, that 12 part
Joseph
classic.
Campbell, yeah.
Yeah, frankly, I'm making Tamerlan into a hero's journey right now. I mean, that's where I'm headed on this one now with this new iteration. And so, I mean, it's a classic way of doing it. It's a structure. Mm-hmm. And if you watch A New Hope and you watch The Force Awakens, they are both right down the line a hero's journey. By the way, you want to talk about a challenge, turning Star Trek into a hero's journey is not easy. Just because it's hard to...
It was set up to be opposite of that.
Yeah.
Right, exactly. And it's already a supernatural world. You know, it's not your normal world. Every day you're in a starship, you know.
Right, and so I think, yeah, Star Trek is more, to me, is more allegory.
Yeah.
Star Wars is, like you said, more of a spiritual journey of the hero and, you know, that kind of thing. I think they're both valid, but they're just, they're different ways of...
Telling a story.
Telling a story, yeah.
Sci-fi has always been... Or not always been, but a big part of sci-fi has always been allegory and having, like, you know, a hidden story or message behind the techno side of it. Like, yeah. You get lost in, and you see the aliens, the weird worlds. But in the end, it's the same moral dilemmas that we're always facing again and again and again. And, you know, it's a different way to examine it and look. And that's what I love about Star Trek. And I love that's when Star Trek is at its best. You know, yeah. I mean, I think it's when it's like make us pause. And like, you know, 2 days later, you're thinking about that episode and you're like, yeah, what about that? You know, and, you know, that's what makes it awesome. So,
well, like one of my favorite episodes from DS9, Duet, you know, that's a first season DS9. That's not the best season for them.
No.
But you've got Duet that one time with the Butcher of Galatep.
The diamond in the rough.
Yeah, and that's that one is where you're like, oh, man, you know where they're headed. I mean, this is not to be – I mean, you know, it all of the, you know, sacrifice of angels later on when we're in the middle of the Dominion War and you've got that episode Sacrifice of Angels or Rocks and Shoals. You know, you can see where – DS9's going mm-hmm. in Duet, right in that first piece. And I think that is why DS9's the one that stands out to a lot of us, because it was a lot more of the interpersonal problems, yeah. You know, and it's investigating yourself and looking into yourself. You know, you've got a Bajoran who has a Bajoran station now that's been taken over from the Cardassians. And here is this Cardassian that is a killer. Well, now, wait a minute. Maybe he's not a killer.
Right.
Well, he should be a killer, and I'm just going to assume he's a killer.
Right.
And then, you know, by the end, she's like, well, wait a minute. You know?
Right. Maybe I was wrong.
Maybe I was wrong. And that's where Star Trek is at its strongest. And I agree with you guys. It's the strength and the power of Star Trek there.
Right.
Is where they're looking into themselves and saying, well, what am I doing here? Yeah. And I think I try to express that if I can in my stories too, because okay. I think that's part of the pieces of it.
Well, that, and hopefully they do this for this, or they have that callback, you know, to that in the new series. However that works, and you know, I'm hopeful for Star Trek Beyond, but I'm not naive.
Yeah. Right.
So,
well, and the trailers haven't been very positive, but Simon Pegg's not hot on the trailer either, and says that's not what the show is about. Well, even, and I'm okay with that.
Even Justin Lin said, you know, he was disappointed with the trailer. So, like, apparently Paramount is
fast
and loose with it.
I'm just like all the other movies, and people have, you know, going to be bashing things because they see things they don't like or they don't. I'm willing to wait.
Oh, I'm definitely. I'm not making any judgments on it.
Yeah,
I'll certainly be there. I mean, it's not like I won't be there.
Right.
You know, I'll be there with my Trekkie uniform on. I'll be happy.
I'll be there day one.
Yeah, me too. I mean, and what do I expect out of the new series? I guess I'm kind of hoping to see Jonathan Swift stories with deep people, with people that mean something, that get caught up in moral quandaries and have to ask themselves questions. And allegories. You know, are we going to let Syrian refugees in, but we won't call them Syrian refugees. We're going to call them Bajoran refugees.
Sure.
But it's the same story. Yeah. We've got that problem in today's world. We're asking that question now. And I want to see that so that they can present it to people in a way that's not
exactly
that doesn't cause the political alignment.
Yeah,
you know, to rupture that we're just examining it, and it's easy to say Bajoran instead of Syrian,
yeah. Right?
You know,
right.
Kind of thing.
You know, and
I really hope, yeah, that they do the allegory thing. But I'm thinking also because they're going to be on that pay per view, like CBS Now thing, that they're probably going to be shorter seasons, and so I'm kind of hoping.
Oh gosh, I hope not.
I mean,
if I'm paid $5 a month, they better give me at least a lot more episodes than.
I hope they do too, but I mean, as things are like shorter seasons, they can maybe come out with a strong arc at the beginning, like a Game of Thrones type thing, like come out swinging with like, you know, a story arc that'll span all the seasons instead of like, oh, we're going to show a whole bunch of random episodes. Because I mean, I think in a world now where Game of Thrones is so popular and so many shows are serialized, where like you got to watch every single episode to know what's happening. Because it's always a cliffhanger, it's always continuing. Sure. Where Star Trek, you know, traditionally it's never been that way, except for maybe Deep Space Nine.
Wow.
Where you can just jump right into most Star Trek and be like, oh, that's entertaining. I just don't know if they're going to be able to do that anymore.
Well, it's a different world. In the 60s, it was a very different world. And so, I mean, you know, you weren't sure that your viewers could see every episode, so you didn't want to risk that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, now we've got Netflix and we've got, you know, video cassettes and all this new technology, which means that we can see every episode. Oh crap! I missed episode 5.
Right.
I'll just go TiVo. I'll look back at my TiVo, and there it is.
Right.
Yeah.
So I think that there's an ability now to do longer arcs. I mean, that was the same thing whenever I was making my comics the first time too, for the same reason. Now mm-hmm. I know you guys can go back to episode 1 or issue 1 and watch the whole thing all the way through.
Right.
But I had to be shown that.
Yeah.
And I actually took that from Order of the Stick, which, you know, is done by Al Berlew, Richard Berlew, I think is his name.
I'm not aware of it.
Order of the Stick was the first time where I realized, oh, I see. I could probably do this as a full-fledged serial and not have to chop it up into little blocks
yeah.
and end it with everybody sitting there going, Spock, you're so human sometimes.
Yeah. And then
the end credits roll.
Yeah.
You know, so, I realized that I think that was the first time when I really grasped that I could go out there on the web and run these series in a long run. And I think we needed to kind of see that.
Mm-hmm.
And we needed to – so in other words, you know, Game of Thrones is out there now doing that. And it's not just Game of Thrones. I mean, The Expanse is coming out on Sci-Fi too, which is all based on James S.A. Corey's beautiful Expanse series, which I absolutely love and everybody should read it. Hmm. And that's just the way it goes. So there.
Exactly.
Exactly. But The Expanse is the same thing. They're running – you have to see episode 1. You have to see episode 2. They're all building on this huge arc.
I can't read.
And I think that... yeah. yeah. So
you're so human.
You're so human.
Mr. Spock. I agree. I think that's the great thing of what the medium that you're working at. You can just keep on going, you know, story after story, and you can make it evolve over time, and it doesn't really need to have the bookends of the beginning and the end, you know. Yes, you might start a
different...
It doesn't
have to be a clean reset at every single time.
Yeah, I mean, and you can start a story arc halfway in the middle of another story arc, you know, and like have it slowly build into the next thing or whatever. So, and you know, people can follow along those little trails and go that way.
For sure.
Yeah.
So maybe I kind of think that it bodes well that they're putting this out on CBS's paper service, because you can go back and watch episode 1 on that one right off the bat.
Well, that's what I do with everything now. I mean, I just binge watch all my shows. I don't.
Sure.
And, you know, so I pay $5 for the CBS network. And when that goes off after 13 episodes, I'll just watch all The Good Wife and Criminal Minds.
Right, exactly. Because that's what we all watch secretly in our rooms while we're crying because we don't have Star Trek.
Exactly.
We're just
I don't want to live in this world.
So I guess really I think that it actually might be a good thing that they're going to run it on CBS streaming, because I think that means that they may do a large arc a la Game of Thrones.
Right.
And they may set it up from the beginning.
That's what I'm hoping, and I'm also hoping they're thinking multiple shows so they could, like, here's another crew, like what Arrow and the Flash are doing. Like, here's another little crew, and then you'll see them once in, like, season one, and then, like, you know.
Well, and the cool thing is we've learned with all these fan films that are coming out is that, you know, we can have these, you can reuse the sets so often. If they're the same fleet, you know, you can just say, okay, you know, the bridge of the Tamerlan is the same as the bridge of the Saladin, you know? You don't have to go back and redo it. I mean, just change a couple things and, you know, rework a few small little details on it.
Well, the thing is with Axanar, they're building a bridge that looks like the Enterprise 1701, but then the bridge is divided up into, like, 8 sections or something, and then they can just rearrange the sections to make it bridge of the Ares or whatever.
Exactly. So that's the beauty of all of that. And if you have a full-fledged studio that has actual money behind it, I mean, why can't you?
Yeah.
You know?
Why
so,
not?
Yeah. I'm hopeful. There's just so many questions just out there hanging in the ether.
Because all we know is that Kirchhoff's working on it.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah. I just there's just too much to – I mean, it's so far away too, so right now, so.
Yeah.
But, that's all very – good things to look forward to. We have a new Star Trek show in 2017. We got Star Trek Beyond. And we have a new story arc from Tamerlan.
Woo!
So, it's a win-win. It's all
we're hoping for.
It's all coming up, Aaron.
All coming up, Aaron?
Yeah.
He's getting all the things he needs, man.
I do. That's it.
Who needs air? I just need these three things.
Yes.
And this chair, and that's all I need.
That's exactly. And this paddle ball. Cool. So it was great talking with you, and we could get this all. Maybe when you get some more of your story arc done, we can have you back. We could talk more about where you're headed, you know. And
I would love that.
Yeah.
Or just have you on just to talk about Star Trek.
Yeah, or whatever.
I will happily come on and do either.
Just pop on and just say, like, hey, guys.
Maybe we can talk about your favorite episode or something. Yeah, the whole episode talking about that. Maybe we'll actually have Faith join us, and maybe she can have some lingering questions from this episode that maybe we didn't ask. Because she always thinks up stuff that we don't ask.
And what Faith does have views that I would never like consider sometimes. That's what's great about her. When she's on, she'll throw something out there like, oh yeah.
And speaking of Faith, unfortunately, we just did 3 episodes on Tribbles. We talked about all the dangers of Sherman's planet and how it's going to be a desolate, barren rock. Nothing good happens.
Nothing
to Sherman's
happens.
Planet.
Sherman planet
ever
is a shithole.
Ever.
You do not want to go to Sherman's
planet.
But
she didn't even listen to her own advice, and she has crash landed on Sherman's planet.
Her and Cyrano Jones.
The Tribbles have eaten through all the food and have chewed through her electrical wiring, so she is having electrical issues with her ship tonight. Which is why she is unable to join us.
I know, it sucks.
It does.
Cyrano Jones and her, what's that dude's name? The guy that was driving Kirk Muttnuts. I can't remember his name at the moment.
I'm bad with names.
Yeah, but...
Cyrano Jones was the one that had the tribbles.
Right, I was trying
no,
to...
No, but the magistrate guy. The guy remember. Who signaled the level one
Leary.
Emergency.
Wasn't it Leary? Yeah, it was...
Something like that. I can't remember. But yeah, so she's stuck on Sherman's planet, wasting away. No quintotriticale.
Right. Since they tried one, it didn't work. They tried another one, it still didn't work.
Nothing works there. Nothing grows.
It's just wrong. Nothing grows on the planet. It's just miserable dust ball of a rock.
That's right.
Yes, and again, all the stuff for Guy Davis's information will be in the show notes. So, again, if you didn't write it down, you didn't get in a car accident.
If you're in a bathroom stall,
don't get in a car accident.
Passed out on the floor because maybe you did too much illegal substances.
Or alcohol or synthol.
LDS in the 60s.
Yes, LDS. LDS most definitely.
We understand, so you can reference this later.
Check the show notes for all the happy links.
And get help, for God's sake.
Yes, yep. but don't give up listening to us, because we're the drug that keeps on giving.
That's right. We're the positive influence. We're the positive influence in your life.
Well, thank you all for listening. Live long and prosper.
Thank you all for listening. All our music is provided by Warp 11. You can find them at warp11.com or follow them on Twitter at warp11. You can find us at synthaholics.com. You can email us at synthaholics@yahoo.com. And you can follow us on Twitter at synthaholicduo. If you'd like to follow us individually, you can follow me at David_J_Duncan.
You can follow me, Aaron O'Brien, at Blackbird2004. Faith, where can they find you?
You can find me at Faith Hertzberg.
And please subscribe to us. We are on iTunes. We are on Stitcher. And if you have a chance, please rate and review so we can improve. And any feedback is welcome. And so we can make the show even better for you.
Live long and prosper, guys. At the stars we did gaze. The next morning he left stinking of gin. Well, McCoy, my boy, come mix me a drink. Before the night's over, I'll puke in the sink. And we'll cry till we laugh, and we'll both shit our pants. You're the best drinking friend I ever had. You're the best drinking friend I've ever had.
I'm gonna kill you.
Oh, no! The roots is us!
No!
The precious is...
Guy, man, that was great. I'm glad we could talk, and I'm glad I could finally get to talk to you person to person. It's been awesome.
Oh, I loved it. Thank you so much for having me on board.
Awesome, awesome.
I'm sorry, I'm allergic to the mold down here, and so I started to get a coughing fit right at the
end. Oh, really?
And so I muted the microphone, so now I sound like I'm all choked up.
It's
all
right.
Tears running down my eyes.
You guys are the best.
Well, see, this is why we use this for the outtakes.
Right.
Well, I was talking to you guys, tears running down my eyes.
Okay, it was so beautiful talking to the Synthaholics. He couldn't stop crying.
I couldn't stop crying. Synthaholics is so awesome.
Those guys suck. So glad I'm done talking to them.
There's only five listeners. I'm not going to get any new views in my comic.
You guys are great, though. I really appreciate being here. Thank you so much.